Hey, it's me, Lars Larson. Thanks for checking out my podcast, and be sure to tell a friend about the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and we'll be glad to get back to your calls a bit later at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com, and you can follow us on Twitter at Lars Larson Show and on Facebook at The Lars Larson Show. And we've got other issues in the Northwest, including the major impediment to travel on a really critical American transportation piece of infrastructure, and that's Interstate 5 that runs from Canada all the way to Mexico. And the biggest choke point on it is a bridge over the Columbia River, on which government has wasted literally hundreds of millions of dollars planning to replace it without actually turning over a single shovel full of dirt or pouring any concrete or putting up any steel. And John Charles joins me now, who's the president and CEO of the Cascade Policy Institute. John, it's good to have you back. You are our transportation go-to guy. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Lars.
So tell me how I should interpret this when the Washington legislature, in a bipartisan vote, agrees to a plan to get the process started again to build a bridge over that river and replace the old bridge. We've got the governor of Oregon who says she's generally in favor. We've got the House Speaker who says she's generally in favor. But then we have the Senate President, Peter Courtney, who says, nope, no way. I'm too stung by the last effort that lasted a decade or so and wasted all that money. And he's just said it's not going to happen. So we have one state that wants to get this done and another state that benefits from it at least equally and maybe even by some arguments more so. And the other state, Oregon, says, nah, we're not going to do it. And I just, for the life of me, can't understand how these folks say we have to have a transportation package passed in Salem to deal with a road here and a road there and all those other things, spend all the billions they're going to spend, and ignore one of the most critical links between the states of Oregon and Washington.
Well, Senate President is sulking. That's not an unusual reaction on a middle school playground, and it's not an unusual reaction in the state legislature. So he has taken his toys and gone home, and he's not going to cooperate. And frankly, that's kind of the Oregon political culture right now. It's kind of the do-nothing state. But I think in a broader view, I would say, as much as I respect Washington State for wanting to restart the conversation, I think their conversation is a little misguided. The Interstate Bridge works generally okay. It is functionally obsolete, but I would not put a lot of money into restarting that conversation. I would say what we really need is two new bridges, one upriver of the I-205 bridge out in the Troutdale area, and one downriver of I-5, because the I-5 corridor itself is so over capacity right now that even if you got a gold-plated replacement of the interstate bridge, you solve a problem, which is the entire corridor all the way down to Wilsonville is over capacity. And there's no way Kate Brown or Peter Courtney or Tina Kotek is going to have anything to do with adding another bridge, because part of the Oregon system is to actually encourage congestion. And we have only two bridges, and you keep it at two bridges, then you're guaranteed to have more congestion.
You know, John, I don't disagree with you that it'd be great to have three bridges. But hey, the journey of 1,000 miles starts with a step, right? And so if you look at one of the biggest choke points, it's got to be I-5. And every time people have said to me, well, let's have a third bridge and let's have it out, toward the gorge, somewhere out, to the east, I say, that's great. But it connects into, as you point out, a system that's already over capacity, Interstate 84, which at least for most of its length, you could probably widen Interstate 84, but only in the places you don't need it as much. As it heads east, as it heads toward downtown Portland, it's physically constrained by light rail, by, physical geography. And so you can't do much to make that much wider. So if you dump all that traffic that now comes down the I-5 corridor onto Interstate 84, I think you've only, you've moved the problem from one place to another with less capability to try to solve the problem. Interstate 5 through the rest of Oregon could arguably be widened, if necessary, through most of the Willamette Valley and even into southern Oregon. There is real estate, where you could expand that freeway. But Interstate 84, when it comes into the dense part of the Portland metro area, I don't know how you'd expand it. It's constrained on both sides, isn't it?
Yes. And to your earlier point, I mean, it's certainly I would prefer that Oregon reengage with Washington to start the conversation. for a new bridge without light rail. And that would be, you know, a civil adult thing to do. As long as it's part of a broader conversation, in my mind, that there needs to be a west side version of I-205, that there needs to be, you know, additional bridge crossings and additional new highways for the Portland region, precisely because I-5 and 84, in terms of expanding their capacity, extremely limited, unless you want to start double-decking, which can be done. It's been done all over the country for decades. You can double-deck facilities, but that's also expensive.
Well, and one of the things I'd point out to you, feel free to tell me I'm wrong, because you study transportation issues a lot more than I do. But the interstate bridge, while it functions reasonably well now, but it has a lift span in it, also has earthquake problems, does it not?
Well, that's true of most bridges in the Portland region. Yes.
Right. But in this case, you have the major hospitals in the region. There are some good ones north of the river, but there are an awful lot of them south of the river. And if we ever have the big one that people keep saying we're going to have sooner or later, because geologically we know it's going to happen, that bridge is probably not going to be just damaged. It's going to go down, and then you're going to have some real transportation problems. You'll be left with one, and especially for that immediate aftermath when that earthquake hits. And I'm hoping it doesn't hit for another few hundred years, but it could happen in the next 10 minutes.
That's true. And if Oregon was serious, you know, then it would obviously put more money into not only rehabilitating and improving existing bridges, but simultaneously hedging our bets by adding some new bridges in new locations built to newer, tougher standards. All those things are worth doing.
Well, and what I'm thinking is, tell me if you think this is wrongheaded, because this isn't so much about the technical side of building bridges. But if you were to actually build a new bridge there, I would think that that would start the conversation of people saying, well, we've got a new bridge there. And let's say it had four lanes each side, north and south. Well, now we need a freeway that lives up to that. And then we start solving those problems. We start improving those things. But you kick it off with that. As opposed to, and even today, I'm getting phone callers who say, well, we can't do that bridge till we do this other choke point. We can't do that choke point till we do these other. It sounds like everybody will always have a reason for why we can't take that first step and start getting something to happen. Whereas if people are anticipating, well, that new bridge is going in, it'll be done in a couple of years. And when that happens, we need to immediately start fixing the other parts of the system and maybe changing it, because I don't like the idea that, you know, I and my family will be trapped in this set of policies where north of the river, they build decent-sized freeways. South of the river, they think if they choke you hard enough, you'll get on the bus or get on light rail. And so far, you've pointed out to me lots that in Europe, where gas is expensive, cars are expensive, licensing is hideously expensive, parking, roads are constrained, even there, per capita driving is not going down, it's going up.
Driving will continue to go up. In fact, the cleaner cars get, the less environmental impact they have per mile.
Yep.
They will go up for the same reason that if you get a high-speed printer in your office, you probably print more, not less. And when you go to high-speed internet, you probably use the internet more, not less.
And
I mean, driving, there's nothing wrong with auto mobility. I'm very supportive of it. And what we don't have in Oregon is an acknowledgement that auto mobility means we need more modern roads, bridges, perhaps tunnels, and probably have a better way to pay for it. I'm certainly supportive of tolling for new facilities and variable pricing to ensure that you get 45 mile per hour minimum speed 24/7, and that's happening with new tolled expressways all across the country. I mean, none of that is theoretical. It is happening, not only in other states, it's happening all around the world as we speak, because it starts with a vision that mobility is a good thing. And our governor and our speaker of the House and the Senate president, they don't even really agree that mobility is a good thing. As you referenced earlier, what they really want to do is inflict pain in the hope that you will get out of your car and do something else.
No, it's not. So call Peter Courtney up. As far as I'm concerned, he's the troll under the bridge in the Three Billygoats Gruff, and all the Billygoats want to do is get across the river. John, thanks so much for the time and for what you do at Cascade Policy.
Thanks, Lars.
You bet. Glad to have you on. Back in just a moment to your phone calls. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and we'll be glad to get back to your calls a bit later at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com, and you can follow us on Twitter at Lars Larson Show and on Facebook at The Lars Larson Show. I'm really glad to be able to welcome to the program Travis Tritton, who is the defense and national security reporter at the Washington Examiner. Travis, thanks for the time.
Sure, it's great to be here.
I've been talking to a bunch of my callers about this, and some of them seem to think that we shouldn't do anything about North Korea, but I want to know from you. 20-plus years of negotiations have produced nothing except, a much more dangerous North Korea. Can we afford to wait much longer before we do something meaningful about stopping or slowing down North Korea's nuclear missile ambitions?
Yeah, well, the real fear is that North Korea is going to, at some point, develop a operational intercontinental ballistic missile, you know, with a nuclear device that can reach the United States. And, you know, many people feel like we can't let it get to that stage. Once we get to that stage, it becomes incredibly more dangerous. So the question is how do you head them off? What do you do? And there's just a menu of really bad options. There's just not a good option there. And I think military force is the option that's just slightly less worse than them actually having a working ICBM.
Well, and I wonder about this because you wrote about the fact that in 1981, Israel hit the Oserak nuclear facility near Baghdad and did a preemptive strike, and that perhaps a preemptive strike, 23, 24 years ago, might have actually done the same thing to North Korea. But are we truly past that point where some kind of strike against their facilities might knock them back out of the nuclear age and back to some place that was something more meaningful? Or are we past that opportunity?
Yeah, I think any kind of U.S. Strike on North Korea creates a huge risk because the North Koreans could retaliate with massive military force. They have artillery pointed at Seoul, and, you know, millions of people could die if there was a miscalculation with any kind of a strike. So when you see a kind of a surgical strike like we saw in Syria with the cruise missiles, I'm not sure that something like that's going to work in North Korea. You know, you just run these huge risks of being engaged in a conventional war on the Korean Peninsula. And you're talking huge casualties. You have huge population centers there. Not only that, you have tens of thousands of U.S. service members and their families stationed there.
Well, let me ask you this, because let me be a little bit selfish about this. I care a lot about the security of my country. If you ask me if I care about South Korea, I care about South Korea. But right now, Kim Jong-un has a gun pointed at the head of South Korea. He has all these guns, all this artillery pointed at Seoul, South Korea. If we sit back and wait, is there any doubt that in a few years, unless he dramatically changes course, he's going to have a gun pointed not at Seoul, South Korea, but at Los Angeles or San Francisco or Seattle? Because he'll be able to reach the West Coast, and maybe sooner than that, he'll be able to reach Hawaii. So when he has the gun pointed at Seoul, South Korea, that's bad. As from my point of view, when he has that gun pointed at Oahu or San Francisco or L.A., that's much worse.
Absolutely, absolutely. That is the fear. You know, the commander, U.S. Pacific Command, came to the Hill this week, and he told lawmakers, look, we need to get missile interceptors on Hawaii. I mean, that's the point that we're at now. And North Korea, as they develop this their missile system, their range just keeps growing larger and larger. And it's only a matter of time before, you know, somewhere like Hawaii, they could target Hawaii or even the U.S. West Coast. The PACOM commander was talking about them being able to hit Washington, D.C. With an ICBM. So I think everybody agrees that we can't let it get to that level. It's just figuring out how to head them off, and that is the real challenge.
Well, then, that's the concern I've got. So putting in missile interceptors, I guess, is a great idea. I mean, I don't have a problem with that. In fact, I think it seems really sensible. But it also seems to presume that he's going to have the missiles and that he's going to have the nuclear weapons miniaturized sufficiently to be able to put a nuclear device on a missile. When you start talking about buying missiles to intercept his missile, haven't you essentially said we're pretty well, we're accepting the idea that he's going to have this weapon and it's going to be pointed at us and that we might have to shoot missile interceptors at one of his missiles in the near future?
Yeah, well, I mean, look, I think there's a lot of disagreement exactly how close North Korea is to developing a working nuclear ICBM. But I think if we get intelligence that they're getting close, I think the appetite for a preemptive strike is going to start going up. I mean, you already see somebody like John McCain who says, if we believe that they have this missile, if we see it on the launch pad, we're going to have to take it out. We cannot let them get in a position to launch an ICBM at the United States. Again, I don't think we're at that point now, but you see the tension being ratcheted up, mostly by the North Korean regime with these constant missile tests.
So do we have this option? If we decided to strike certain of the production facilities, the places where he's making the nuclear materials or the nuclear devices and the launch pads for these missiles, if we decided to do that and decided that a military strike was necessary, could we simultaneously take out most or all of the artillery on the north end of the DMZ?
You know, I think this has probably been war game to death. I mean, people have been studying this for decades. About how we could take out North Korea if we had to. And I think just the understanding is that the United States would prevail in the end, but we probably couldn't do it quickly, that it would take a conventional war. It would probably take some ground forces, and we would have to fight it out, and it would be bloody. You know, I think we could do a massive strike, but I don't think there's a lot of certainty that we could get all of their nuclear facilities or their nuclear weapons that we know exactly where they're at. And, I don't think there's certainty that we could take out all of their artillery positions, which would still allow them to target South Korea and Seoul.
Boy, it's a bad situation all the way around, isn't it? Travis, thank you very much for the time, and thanks for the work you do for the Washington Examiner.
Thank you.
Back in just a moment to your phone calls. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. It's a great pleasure to have with me Stuart Taylor Jr., who's the author of a number of books, but this time a co-authoring with Casey Johnson, Rape Panic, The Attack on Due Process at American Universities. Mr. Taylor, there's a case we covered in my neck of the woods at the University of Oregon that involved a group of football players. There was, as usual in these cases, a party. There were people who had gone willingly to it. There was a young woman who had gone with some men. She became intoxicated. She became sexually, she engaged in sex of one kind or another with several of the men and then went off with them willingly to an apartment. She then said that she was raped. She spent the night, woke up the next morning, and apparently told the police she had sex again with the man that she would later accuse of raping her, and then she left. And in fact, she didn't report it. It was a family member who became aware of it, reported it. The local district attorney looked at the case and said, look, we do not have the elements here to form a rape charge and to take this to the grand jury or to trial, and they simply dismissed it. The university then took it up and said, okay, we're going to have a hearing. And the hearing, and I want you to describe how these typically go at universities, not that case in particular, but they decided that these three young men should be, kicked out of the university and taken off the athletic teams that they were part of. Is that the kind of picture that we're starting to see on American college campuses, and is that an example of, say, the way this problem happens?
There have been several cases that sound almost exactly like that. The one you mentioned in Oregon, there's one almost exactly like that at the University of Minnesota, where their football team got suspended or kicked out. Some of the cases, the famous cases at Baylor, seem to have that characteristic, i.e. what appears to be consensual sex with drunken women by a group of men. And let's, this is pretty ugly conduct by the men, right?
Absolutely.
But it's not a crime if she was, conscious and if she was willing. And there are a fair number of cases like that, and the universities tend to treat them as though they were real rapes. The typical case is a one-on-one case, not a group case. but there are group cases. And there have also been some group cases that were real rapes. Vanderbilt, there was such a case we talk about it in our book, where the woman was genuinely passed out and was carried to a dorm room by a group of football players who had sex with her in succession. And one of them was filming it, which is how, and, you know, they're being criminally prosecuted. When there's a real rape of that kind, the answer is criminal prosecution, not to have some university put on a kangaroo court.
But how is it that the universities don't see that putting somebody in front of a campus court where there is not the presumption of innocence, there isn't a standard of beyond a reasonable doubt, there isn't even necessarily an opportunity, and I want you to speak to this, to cross-examine your accuser, but that real-life consequences are being brought down in the form of punishments, how is it that this isn't being challenged in the courts as a violation of one's due process rights?
Well, that is what's happening. I mean, the procedures in these courts, campus courts, and I could elaborate, you know, are really shamefully biased. They're rigged. They're designed, and to some extent under orders of the Obama administration, the procedures are rigged to presume guilt and to try and get people punished, even if the balance of the evidence suggests that they did nothing wrong, or at least nothing criminal. And so, why do they do it? They do it, I think, in part, you know, often when people react in a fanatical way, there's some germ of a good reason for it. And the germ here is, many years ago, campuses tend to sweep real rapes under the rug when they happen on campus. You know, they didn't want to get the reputation as the rape school. And in decades past, police were not particularly there. They tended to be kind of cynical about rape allegations. They took real victims and treated them badly. So there was a reason why people wanted the colleges themselves to do something about this. Unfortunately, it's been a wild overreaction, and the campuses have not only proved, the colleges have not only proved completely incompetent to bring, you know, to do a fact-finding of this kind in a responsible way that leads to an accurate result, they're ideologically biased. The colleges are run by, a lot of them, by a bunch of sick puppies who are very biased against males and in favor of females, and that bias kind of loads the whole process.
I'm talking to Stuart Taylor Jr., who's the co-author of Rape Panic. You've looked at a couple of dozen of these cases. How often does the university's process end up contaminating or even ruining any opportunity to do a criminal prosecution, if one were possible?
Quite often. Oh, to ruin a criminal prosecution.
By the local authorities.
I've never known it to mess up a criminal prosecution. What does happen is that women who perhaps were real victims, who should have gone to the police if the idea is to put the rapist out of commission by locking him up, are channeled by the colleges saying, "No, don't go to the police. They'll be mean to you. We'll be nice to you. You know, you'll have to be cross-examined by some nasty defense lawyer if you go to the police. Come to us. There won't be any cross-examination. We know the guys are guilty. We'll take care of that. We'll get them kicked out for you."
Does that also open up the door for things like the Rolling Stone story that involved Virginia Tech, where a Rolling Stone reporter encountered somebody who said, "Well, I've been raped, I've been assaulted, it happened this way," and then a huge story is done, a lot of damage is done on campus to both social organizations like fraternities and to the campus itself, and yet no good came of it. If anything, a lot of careers were ruined, and people's lives could have been ruined as well.
Yeah, that was a complete fraud, that case, and it points to the dishonorable and dishonest role often played by the media, the mass media, in these cases. This case, Sabrina Erdely was the name of the author. She wrote for Rolling Stone. She searched around the country, went from campus to campus to try and find a really outrageous rape case that she could portray as typical of what goes on campus every day, and she didn't really find any. So she did come across a woman who had made up a wild and crazy and completely implausible story for reasons that have something to do with her own psychological problems of having been gang raped on broken glass after breaking a tabletop by 7 to 9 fraternity brothers at a particular fraternity at the University of Virginia. She made this story up in the hope of getting sympathy, and especially from a guy she had a crush on. Well, the media and the bureaucrats at the University of Virginia just, and Rolling Stone, of course, they all just lapped this up. It was, if you read her description of what happened, I think most people would say, wait a minute, this doesn't really sound very realistic. But to the media, it sounded just fine, and it was treated with great credulity by virtually all the major publications in the country until it fell apart because it was a bunch of lies. Now, one little rare exception to the bad role by the media in this case was a Washington Post reporter actually helped debunk this story and prove its inaccuracy. But most of the media never apologized.
His most recent book is called Rape Panic: The Attack on Due Process at American Universities. It is authored by Casey Johnson and my guest Stuart Taylor Jr. We'll be back in just a moment. Glad to get your emails. talk@LarsLarson.com. Follow us on Twitter, Lars Larson Show, on Facebook, The Lars Larson Show, and we'll be right back in just a moment. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show on Compass Media. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. It's a great pleasure to have with me Stuart Taylor Jr., who describes himself as occasionally practicing law, but mostly just writing fascinating books, like the most recent one, Rape Panic, The Attack on Due Process at American Universities. So you've told us that there's a situation that people are being told that there's one woman in five on American college campuses will be raped, something that would scare the daylights out of moms and dads who send their kids off to college hoping to get a good education but thinking my daughter may be one of those one in five, that the statistics do not bear it out, that the experience doesn't bear it out. And we just finished talking about Rolling Stone, which could have done a story that would be, you know, almost a good prologue to your book, saying we looked all over American college campuses and couldn't find a situation like this till we ran into this fake story. Let me ask you how we go about fixing this. You've also described the campuses as perhaps overcompensating to make up for past bad acts or past bad behavior when the college didn't take real rape cases seriously. But how do we dial this back to where we respond appropriately to the sexual assaults that do happen and don't have kangaroo courts that kick people out without considering their constitutional rights to due process?
Well, it could begin with the Trump administration. There's a lot the Trump administration could do. They couldn't really fix the problem, but they could certainly make things better. And I'm not a particular supporter of Trump, but this is one area where everything the Obama administration did, just about everything on the campus sex front, campus rape front, was bad. And just wiping it all off the books would be good. And this isn't legislation we're talking about. They did it by bureaucratic tyranny, by issuing orders to the campuses claiming that they were interpreting Title IX, the sex discrimination statute, but they weren't really interpreting Title IX. They were making stuff up and pretending that it was based on Title IX. And so getting rid of all of that federal overlay would be good. And there are some bad laws that states have adopted, particularly deep blue states like California and New York, that adopt guilt-presuming procedures. The way they define, for example, sexual assault would encompass most voluntary sex. And so then it becomes just arbitrary. But it needs a much deeper solution than that, because the attitude and the culture of presuming everyone accused of a sex offense to be guilty is woven into the fabric of the universities now, the leadership, the bureaucrats, the sex bureaucrats, the professors, a lot of them, and even a lot of the students have been propagandized to the point where they believe this. And so getting back to a balance where we go after real rapists and not after everyone whose date is unhappy afterwards is a real challenge for the country. And, of course, we don't want to overcorrect again and get to the point where women have no recourse. But I think the best approach the colleges should take, first, the Trump administration should also strike out against anti-male sex discrimination, and a lot of these cases involve that. We need to have, I think channeling these cases back to police and prosecutors is the best way to go. In an ideal world, maybe the campuses would have a role in punishing people accused of sex crimes, but in the world we live in, they've demonstrated that they're not fit to do that, and that there isn't any way to improve on police and prosecutors in this area.
Well, for instance, if a case has been taken to the police have forwarded it to the local prosecutor or DA, and they have looked at it and said the evidence isn't there. And usually those kinds of details can't be made public because of the very nature of the accusation. It's bad for both the person who says I was victimized and it's bad for the person who's accused of doing it. If the DA decides we're not going to prosecute this, we don't have a case. If that's handed back to the university, should the university do anything with a case like that?
Well, what they should certainly do from the start is, in terms of the way they treat women who come to the university officials and say, I've been sexually molested or raped or whatever, they should treat them with kindness for purposes of how they relate to the woman. They should give them the benefit of the doubt that they're telling the truth. There should be rape crisis centers. There should be medical attention. There should be psychological attention. There should be counseling, all of that. Where the line is being drawn in the wrong place now is when you get down to identifying, usually it's easy to identify, usually a woman knows the guy she's accusing. When you get down to the question of, okay, what do we do about him? I think maybe if it's a non-criminal accusation, such as sexual harassment, which is not a crime, there's a role for the universities. But when you get to actual criminal allegations, they should be handled by the criminal authorities, and the universities should stay out. Of course, after the criminal authorities have done their job, and then if the guy gets, say, indicted, the university can suspend him, and if he gets convicted, they can certainly kick him out. But kicking somebody out with the brand of a rapist on him, based on the kinds of kangaroo court structures they have now, is doing more harm than good.
What about these codes that some of the universities have come up with that require affirmative consent for each and every act? And I mean, every time I hear about one of these, I wonder, how does this work in practice? A young man and a young woman meet at a party. They've each had a couple of beers. And the young man says, may I kiss you? And, you know, it's almost like taking us back 100 years. And the young woman says, why, certainly kiss me, but, you know, don't put your hands on me. And I mean, how are those things problematic as well as being kind of unenforceable and unworkable?
Yes, and this is something that a lot of colleges, hundreds I think now, have adopted on their own just because of the ideologue factor. And there are a couple of states, I mentioned New York and California and also Connecticut and I think might be Illinois, have adopted this as a matter of law, but only for college students, not for, say, members of the state legislature. People used to do parodies about this sort of thing on Saturday Night Live, but now it's very serious. You know, may I touch your hand? May I give you a kiss? May I do this? May I do that? And unless there's a may I, or at least a very, you know, very clear body language, at every single step of, let's say, the escalation of a sexual encounter, the woman, usually, can always say, well, yes, I said he could do this, but I didn't say he could do that. And the guy will say, well, she sure acted like I could do that. But under the, you know, under this so-called affirmative consent law, there's no such thing as safe sex, at least if you're the guy. You can always be treated as a rapist if the woman later on decides that she wants that to happen.
Should those codes be thrown out then?
They should, for sure. The laws of the states that define rape and sexual assault used to be too restrictive. It used to be the woman had to struggle and scream and fight, and that was too much of a burden to put on the victim.
Mr. Taylor, it's a pleasure to have you on the program. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
The book is called Rape Panic, The Attack on Due Process at America's Universities, and you're listening to The Lars Larson Show.
Under the president's leadership and guided by his executive orders, we will secure this border and bring the full weight of both the immigration courts and the federal enforcement and prosecutors to combat this attack on our national security and our sovereignty.
Attorney General Jeff Sessions on the border in Nogales, Arizona this week, and he's on the phone with me right now. General Sessions, it's good to have you on the program again.
Thanks, Lars. Good to be back with you.
And the first time in your new role as Attorney General, and it sounds as though we're beginning to win the fight against illegal aliens in America.
It is. I can't tell you how exciting it is. I know I said on your show some years ago that if we had presidential leadership and sent a clear message, people would stop coming illegally. That's what we want to happen. We're not trying to see how many people can be arrested, how many people have to be detained. We want to send the message, the border is not open. Apply legally. Do not come illegally. These numbers are the lowest in 17 years. The March total was the lowest in 17 years. So this is something to be excited about. And then in addition, with the numbers down, you have more Border Patrol and ICE officers and customs officers to deal with the fewer numbers, and they can do a better job of dealing with them. We're going to send in more judges. We've already got a group that are there. We're going to have 50 more within a few weeks and then 75 next year. So we want to end this catch and release where people demand a trial and we don't have room for them, so they have to let them out on bail, and, of course, they don't come back to court, which makes a mockery of the system. So, yes, it's a pretty exciting, I got to say. Got a lot long way to go. There's still way too much. They'll change their tactics, many of them will, but we've made some big progress, no doubt.
I'm talking to Attorney General Jeff Sessions. General, tell me this. Part of this is you made the vow in Nogales that you will arrest every single adult who crosses the border illegally instead of the catch and release policy, as you said. Does that mean that you then lock them up and then quickly speed them in front of a federal judge so the judge can quickly hear their case? And how quickly, under the Constitution and the laws you've got, can you turn them back around and return them to their home countries?
Well, many of them, once they're caught, know the jig is up, and they admit and accept being deported, except under the Obama administration, too often they seem to be have no real interest in that and created confusion. So if you're clear about it, many will be deported immediately. But if they were coyotes who brought in a group of people, they need to be prosecuted. If they brought drugs in, they need to be prosecuted. If they've already been deported once for a criminal offense and here they come again, you got to prosecute those cases. You just can't send them back. And so once you do that and send that message, I think we'll continue to see a decline in illegal entrance. And we particularly want to reduce the number of criminals that are coming across the border.
General Sessions, let me ask you about sanctuary cities. Several hundred sanctuary cities that have declared that status around America. It seems to me, but I want to know from you, it seems to me that they're violating at least two sections of the federal code, and you know them well, 8 U.S. Code 1324 and 8 U.S. Code 1373, that say, first, it's illegal for any government agency or official to in any way restrict information about people who've come in illegally. But the second one, the more serious one, is that any person who, knowing that an illegal alien has come to the U.S. in violation of the law, conceals, harbors, or shields them from detection shall be imprisoned for not more than 5 years. It seems to me, and I'm not a lawyer like you are, and a former prosecutor and a former judge, but it seems to me that there are a number of both city officials and even in some cases sheriffs and police chiefs who are in fact shielding illegal aliens in their jails. Any chance that the Justice Department is going to bring charges to send a warning shot across their bow as well?
We will be studying the various laws, but I've made clear that if we believe the facts justify, we do, that if you get a federal grant that's a law enforcement grant or related type grants, the government has a right to ask as a condition of that grant that you comply with these laws and you not block federal agents from doing their duty. And why in the world a mayor or a council, usually they're the ones telling the police chiefs what to do, the liberal councils and so forth.
Yeah.
Telling the police not to turn over a criminal that's just been convicted in state court, let's say, for drug dealing so they can be deported, why they would not want that to happen, it baffles me. And that is, of course, the tragic Kate Steinle story of it. The father in whose arms she died testified before our committee about a year ago. And this guy had been deported 5 or 6 times, had 7 felony convictions, specifically came to San Francisco because it was a sanctuary city. And she was murdered. We don't need to allow this to happen. People who have these kind of criminal histories need to be deported. And I intend to do what I can to help our Homeland Security team and prosecute their cases when they make them.
General Sessions, do you believe those city council members and county commissioners are violating that federal law when they give those directives?
Lars, I'm not going to make an opinion on that today.
Oh, darn.
I would say they're violating the interest of their own citizens. They're placing their communities at greater risk by not following what the law, not cooperating and doing what the law says. Once you're convicted of these type serious crimes, the law says you shall be deported. It doesn't say maybe. It says you shall be, and our federal officers absolutely need to be there to receive these individuals when they get out of jail, and they need to be deported. But if you're not being told about it and they don't have notice about it, then you're not able to have our officers be there to pick them up. And that's the big frustrating thing. It violates all traditions of law enforcement. Cities, counties, states have always been able to place detainers. So when you finish with a person, we want to take him to the next county and prosecute him there. And the federal government does that also. We say that when you finish with him in your jurisdiction, we want to take him and maybe try him for an offense and submit him for deportation because he's to be deported. When you have cities and all blocking this, it's just breathtaking to me and how stupid and unwise it is.
General Sessions, let me ask you about another subject, the Civil Rights Division. I know you've only been on the ground, confirmed, for less than a dozen weeks or so, but it seems to a lot of conservatives that there's real ideological rot in the Justice Department Civil Rights Division. Do you plan to do something about that?
Well, I plan to enforce our civil rights laws. Our police officers are not entitled to violate civil rights, and neither is anyone else. And so we're going to enforce those laws. That's part of what Congress has ordered us to do, and it's the right thing to do. So we're going to do that. I do have some different approaches to issues, such as taking over police departments and issuing 200-page orders that many of those orders are really bad for policing and public safety and diminish the ability of the officers to conduct constitutionally approved procedures. We should not do that. So we'll make a number of changes in a number of areas on some of the ideas about what the Civil Rights Division would do. I expect the members of our division to work many and overwhelmingly their career attorneys, and they do respond to the leadership at the top. So, you know, we'll have a problem if people refuse to, you know, follow through on established policy.
General Sessions, you've been very generous with your time, and I think you're doing a fantastic job. Keep doing it, and we appreciate the time today.
Thank you.
It is a pleasure to have you on. Attorney General Jeff Sessions, back in just a moment. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Shannon, welcome to The Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind?
Good afternoon, Lars. I am one of your naysayers for the Boy Scouts and allowing this transgender boy in.
All right, tell me why.
Well, from my perspective, why deny this young man all of the great things that the Boy Scouts have to offer, you know, the ethics and the skill learning and the camaraderie? Why deny that child this?
Because of what the problematic situation that you create for all the other members of that group. And there are other...
What situation is that?
Well, for instance, you decide to take a bunch of Boy Scouts camping, and you say, we're all going to be out there, and the Boy Scouts are the Boy Scouts rather than the co-ed Scouts, because they have a bunch of young boys who go camping, and they don't go camping and share tents and sleeping bags with girls. There's a reason for that, and I think we all understand those reasons, and if you don't, go call your mom and dad and get the Birds and the Bees lecture again. But
well,
it becomes problematic, doesn't it?
Words. You've never been one to mince words. Why don't you just go ahead and say what you think the problem will be?
I think the problem is that it will create problems of privacy, problems of embarrassment, potentially even problems of what usually happens if you put, you know, teenage boys and girls together sleeping overnight with not a lot of adult supervision. You can have problems with that. And if you don't understand that, tell me that you think this will not be problematic for some of the other scouts.
So you think that every co-ed situation at that age
You keep asking me questions in answer to my questions to you. How about this? Why don't we
lie? Say that just the Boy Scouts.
Well, let me ask you something.
When there's other co-ed situations, they're completely safe in that situation. Why can't we make it safe? Why can't we make the Boy Scouts?
But they're designed as co-ed situations. And even in co-ed situations, I used to go on speech trips overnight out of town for 2 or 3 days. They did not house the boys and girls together. Would you be in favor if your local school district said, when we send boys and girls sports teams out of town, if we run out of rooms, we'll house some of the boys or the girls? Would you be okay with that?
As long as they're properly supervised,
how in the world do you properly supervise? You're going to put a 16-year-old boy and a 16-year-old girl, house them in the same room, have them use the same facility, sleep in the same bed. How do you supervise that?
They wouldn't be in the same facility, Lars. They wouldn't be on the same bed. And the scout leader that called in earlier said that on the radio. They have separate facilities for just this situation.
Except now you have to, now the Boy Scouts, to accommodate a group of 20 boys with one transgender who's really still a girl, has to somehow create a whole separate situation for that person, which is probably going to be uncomfortable for that person because it's going to make them stand out from the rest of the group. Unless you adopt the philosophy that if somebody calls themselves transgender, then they've actually changed their gender. Well, at 14, they haven't. There aren't surgeons in this country that are willing to break their ethical bounds and start to do surgery on 12-year-old or 13-year-old boys and turn them into girls. So I think that this is trying to accommodate an adult concern that's a political concern about transgender and lesbian and bisexual and gay politics and impose it on a group of children.
Disagree, Lars. It's about what's best for the child. And you keep saying young girl, and that just isn't the situation. And I understand that this is complex and it's hard to understand at first, but this young child, if they identify as a boy and they've gone through the steps, they've gone through the therapy, and that is who they truly are.
Which steps are you thinking of? Nobody's gone through the surgery.
Healthcare provider. No. I'm not talking about a physical change at all. I'm talking about knowing yourself and who you are and going to a mental health care provider that specializes in this kind of thing.
Can I ask you a couple of questions in aid of an objection? If you'll answer them quickly, because I'll go through a bunch of them. Is a 16-year-old girl capable of deciding to get a tattoo or a piercing?
Not legally.
Okay. Is she capable of deciding to smoke cigarettes? Have an abortion, any of these other things? Is she?
Legally, no.
Okay. Although legally in the Northwest, at least in Oregon, the 12-year-old can get an abortion, which is shocking enough. But if we've decided as a society, this girl isn't old enough to decide to get a tattoo, to go to a sun tanning parlor, to smoke cigarettes, or any of those other things, but she is old enough to decide at 12 or 14 that she is actually a boy, even though she was born with girls' parts.
But it's not just her decision, Lars. It's her decision. It's her parents' decision. It's the mental health care.
Hold on. Your parents can decide what gender you are?
It's all about the support of the people you have around you. And it's also up to the organization that chartered the scouting group to decide that you will accommodate or they will not accommodate this situation. So if there's a chartered organization that's willing to accept somebody for who they are and care about them and provide them the accommodation they need, why deny them that wonderful
opportunity? Let me ask you something. Do you remember a young lady from Spokane named Rachel Dolezal?
I don't.
She said she was black.
Okay.
She was the head of one of the local groups that represents black people in America, and she insisted she was black. Now, she wasn't black. Her parents weren't black. Her siblings weren't black. She was not black, but she insisted she was. So by your logic, if I insist tomorrow that I'm black, am I now a black American? Because
well,
I say so.
Somehow delegitimize someone's gender identity, which is pretending to be black. And there's a very big
playing along with
transgender people are not pretending.
Shannon, I'm trying to play along with this. We've already established that a child of that age is not capable of making most of the decisions that you can make as an adult.
You're also saying that it's a decision, and it's not. It's a state of being. It's a simple truth this child comes to terms with, you know, with the help and the support of the people around them. So I'm asking, since this person, this young man, isn't able to go into the Girl Scouts because they are a young man and identify as such, they aren't able to go into the Boy Scouts because you don't think they should, even though they're being provided by the Boy Scouts a safe place to do so, where are they to go?
Shannon, let me ask you a couple of questions in aid of an objection. Can we make it quick?
Sure.
Okay. Why can't he, as you call she, why can't he go in the Girl Scouts?
Because he's a young man.
Well, no, hold on.
And it's important,
he thinks
for,
he's
it's
a
important
young man.
For people at this age
okay.
to be around.
I thought we were going to do this quickly. Shannon, are there young ladies who wear pants and clothing that's indistinguishable from young men's clothing?
Absolutely.
Okay. So if a young woman believes she's actually a young man and she wears boys cut jeans and boys cut shirts, she can do that. And everybody can call her one name or another name. That doesn't matter. You're telling me it's internal to her. Why can't that young woman join the Girl Scouts and simply say, since my body looks like a girl, my mind tells me I'm a boy, I'm comfortable with that, I'll join the Girl Scouts, and then there's no problem created.
Why would you put a young boy in?
I didn't ask that. I said, why? You said she can't join the Girl
Scouts.
You're
making an argument over, you're delegitimizing.
No, I'm not delegitimizing anything. She can
identity. Well, then why won't you call them by their pronoun and identify them as the gender they identify as?
Because DNA, physical appearance, and a birth certificate says it's a girl. And you're insisting that because her brain says, I'm a boy, that the rest of society has to play along with the hallucination. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. Glad to get your phone calls and emails in a moment, but we've got something important I want to do, and that is talk to Dr. Tyler Cowen, who insists that I call him Tyler. He's the author most recently of The Complacent Class, The Self-Defeating Quest for the American Dream. And when I saw this, I thought, Dr. Cowen, I have to know what the premise is, and I looked into the book, and I thought, this is really interesting because I see myself in a lot of the description that you've written of this this American population in repose. So as I understand the thesis, Europeans mostly, came to this continent first, these were adventurers. These were people willing to take big risks and go out and take chances and get the rewards that came with it. And today, you posit an American class that, that they want comfort. They want to move to a neighborhood of people like them. They want to live in a house that is, you know, a house that they can afford. And they want to be around people who are like them. And they effectively have eschewed any kind of risk taking. And you think that in the long term, this is going to be really bad for America.
That's right. It's taking away our dynamism. We move across state lines less often. We medicate ourselves much more. We hardly ever let our children play outside. We regulate our economy too much. And overall, we care too much about security and safety.
Now, whose problem is this to fix? And the reason I ask that is I'm also one of those people who's averse to the idea of having the government do social engineering. I mean, I guess I'd accept that, you know, the offer of the deductibility of mortgage interest on your home is a little bit of social engineering to encourage people to buy houses rather than to rent housing. But other than that, I would like the government to stay out of my business. So how do you go about getting an entire population to say, I want to move to a neighborhood where I'm a bit uncomfortable, or maybe I'm a little, you know, out of place, and I'll take a job doing something that I'm, you know, I'm not necessarily all that sure I'm competent at. Is that what you're getting at?
I'm trying to give people that sense of urgency. I don't see government as the solution. In part, government's part of the problem. We have a government that way back when needed only 7 years to put a man on the moon. These days, we can't build a bridge in 7 years. Sometimes we can't even rename a bridge in 7 years. Our government has become more and more about spending money to protect people.
Yeah, and so how do we move away from that? And, I mean, and is, say, Donald Trump, who promises to get rid of 2 federal regulations for every 1 new one that is adopted, is this one of the ways that'll work, or is that going to fail as well?
I believe that will fail. So bureaucrats will simply relabel what counts as one regulation. They'll take a whole bunch of regulations and just call it one, and that won't have much effect. Keep in mind, Trump himself has promised not to touch entitlement spending. I'm not sure he will succeed in getting this country to spend more on research and development. Trump is promising a lot of change, but I think ultimately a lot of his policies will prove defensive, and his rhetoric is that of looking backwards rather than forwards.
I'm
it's
talking
not the grand new vision, it's make America great again.
I didn't mean to interrupt you, Dr. Cohen. Yeah, Tyler Cohen is with me, PhD and New York Times bestselling author, most recently of The Complacent Class. Well, let me ask you about one specific thing from the president's speech last night. He talked about the fact that federal regulations now currently make it very difficult for pharma companies to be able to bring new drugs to market that might save people's lives or improve their lives. Now, I'll accept your point that we're a far more medicated society than we probably ought to be, and certainly than we used to be. But if he's successful at rolling back some of those regulations, doesn't that in itself, in the microcosm, say we're going to let pharma companies take greater risk because they will have greater rewards by being able to get these drugs to market quicker?
I was very happy to hear Trump say that. I do feel that's an area where he has a good chance of being effective. I'm hopeful he'll appoint someone very sophisticated to head the FDA. But even there's a problem that most of the staff at the FDA does not have the same incentive. Their incentive is to play it safe and slow down or delay the development of new drugs so they don't get blamed. So whether Trump and his appointee can overcome all of that bureaucratic inertia, I'm hopeful. I'm delighted he's made it an issue, but we haven't yet seen the change come.
Tyler, is there a way to re-engineer the way the government bureaucracies work so that there is an incentive? Because you're the economist, not me, but you know that if you go to work in a private sector company, the usual incentive is get products to market, get things done, because when things stop happening, money, revenue stops flowing into the company, and everybody knows that my paycheck is dependent on the company doing well. But as you say, in a government bureaucracy, your paycheck may be dependent on making sure that you never, ever, ever make a mistake. And if you say, well, then we can take forever to approve a drug because that way I will reduce the incidence of mistakes and increase my longevity in my federal job.
In my lifetime, I've seen our government become a big insurance company. One can debate what should be the proper size of government, but for any given size, I think we should spend more on infrastructure, more on research and development, more on dynamism, and less on simply protecting everyone's income and health care in every way possible. In the long run, we'll actually be much safer if we're dynamic. That's the counterintuitive point.
I get that point, but Tyler, when you say we should spend more, the we could be government, we could be the private sector, the we could be individuals. Which we are you talking about investing more in?
All of those we's.
All, including
government.
We all
need to make that decision. And ultimately, it will come from the citizens. Government does actually respond to some extent to what voters want. And voters have asked for more complacency. That's part of our problem. We get the government we deserve all too often.
Well, I've heard that 100 times, but do we get the government we deserve when the people of Alabama, say, send a state a member of Congress back to Capitol Hill, and he says, well, if the Pentagon's going to make a new airplane, I want the tires or the wings or something else to be made in Alabama. And I want to make sure that some of those jobs come to my district or even to my state if I'm a senator. That actually makes sense for his state. It may not make sense for the whole country, and it may lead to the Pentagon building a lot of things that they don't actually need. But how do you get the rep from Alabama to say, I'm going to do what's good for the whole country, even if it works against my own district?
I think voters have to actually demand true fiscal conservatism, which we do not have right now. There's still a sense we can pay for anything by just issuing more debt. And if that's your attitude, you'll let all kinds of little things slip because you'll say, oh, we don't really have to pay for this right now. Again, I think we're very far from making the changes we need to. It requires a whole new cultural mindset. It's not just a question of some political movement or some individual leader. But that's what I think has to happen. People have to see it as an urgent matter that we stop wasting money through government, not just a question of rhetoric.
You mentioned reforming the entitlements. I agree with you. 2/3 of the federal budget is made up of entitlements. But how do you go about doing that when it means someone's grandmother's Social Security check is going to get cut or maybe even denied if it's means tested?
The way it's most likely to happen is that people who are older will keep the benefits they have been promised, but at some age level, the deal has to be different. And again, I think Trump has actually moved us away from that kind of realization. The Republicans in Congress have a clearer sense that that needs to be done. Trump, in essence, is telling people we don't have to do it.
Well, but let me ask you something. The Republicans, I've never thought the Republicans got all. I'm a Republican. I'm a conservative, I think. Maybe after I read your book, I'll decide that I'm not. I'm a person in repose. But, Tyler, when President Bush, you know, way back in the day, said we need to reform Social Security, both his own party and the opposition party said, no, we're not going to do that. And if we had started the reform, you know, 15 years earlier, we'd at least be better off than starting it today or next year or next decade.
I fully agree. The problem there was the voters. Keep in mind, the Bush administration, when Republicans controlled all branches of government, they increased government spending at a higher pace than had the Democrats. So for me, it's not really a party matter. Both parties end up bad when they're in control. I think it's ultimately a matter of the cultural fabric of this country needing to change.
I'm talking to Dr. Tyler Cohen, who holds the Holbert Harris Chair in Economics at George Mason University. He's a New York Times bestselling author, most recently of The Complacent Class, The Self-Defeating Quest for the American Dream. We'll be back in just a moment. Glad to get your phone calls and emails, 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk at LarsLarson.com. And you're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Glad to get your emails. Talk at LarsLarson.com. You can also call in later at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Follow us on Twitter at Lars Larson Show and on Facebook at The Lars Larson Show. I'm speaking with Dr. Tyler Cohen, who's insisted I call him Tyler, who is an economist at George Mason University. He is a best-selling author and most recently of The Complacent Class, The Self-Defeating Quest for the American Dream. Now, let me ask you about one of the central premises of the book, and that is that human beings today, in today's society, American society, say, I'm going to gravitate toward what is comfortable. And I told you I saw myself in that description to some extent. I'm going to buy the house that I think is best for my family, and it's likely to be in a neighborhood that is full of people that are similar to me in a lot of ways. And you say this leads to bad things like segregation. How does it lead to it, and is that necessarily a bad thing if it's done by my choice and the choice of other Americans?
Each individual wants to live next to like-minded others because they enjoy it or in some way benefit from it. But I think when everyone in society does it, it becomes a collective action problem, that there's too little mobility, too little mixing, too little dynamism. It's harder for poor people to rise through the ranks for the most part. And part of that is because it's so expensive to try to move into Manhattan or San Francisco to get a better job. So I think we're failing our nation when we do this so completely and cement it in with government-backed zoning and regulation. To me, it's a worrying sign. The older, more dynamic America truly was in some ways more mixed by income and education, and that was healthy.
Tyler, I worry that your prescription here, your diagnosis of our problem, is going to lead to governments who start to talk about things like inclusive zoning, which is even more government. I mean, I'm sure you've run into the idea, but it's currently under discussion in my neck of the woods in Oregon and Washington, where government leaders say, we will force the mixing. We will insist that developers build housing of various kinds in which the doctor and the lawyer and the engineer are going to live next to the bus driver or the garbage man or the waitress, because we're going to tell the developer that he has to provide that housing specifically for people of lower economic status to be able to live there. But I'm not sure, Doc, does it actually happen that if the waitress or the garbage man lives next door to the doctor, that necessarily increases his economic fortunes?
I don't want to force anything, but the net impact of force has been regulations restricting what developers can build in cities. So I would just like to do more deregulation of building. Much of Texas has fairly deregulated building and building codes, and there's more mixing in Texas, and a lot of people have moved there for cheaper housing for that reason. And that's worked quite well. Texas has become a much wealthier, better-off state. So it can be done in a way that works, and I think it's less coercive than what you see in Portland or Manhattan or San Francisco or Beverly Hills.
And when you talk about segregation, are we talking about classical segregation, that is either economic segregation or even racial segregation?
It's both of those. More and more, it's also by education. So some parts of America, people don't know anyone who voted for Donald Trump. Other parts of America, well, you can drive from one coast to another without going through any county that favored Hillary Clinton in the election. That, to me, is amazing.
It is amazing.
In Washington, D.C., I know people will say, how could Trump have won? I don't know anyone who voted for him.
At that point, you start to quote Pauline Kael, right, on Nixon, saying, I don't know how he won. Nobody I knew voted for him. But doesn't that suggest that some of the people who live on the two coasts are living in their own little protected bubbles and don't realize there's a great big America out there that they've never visited?
On both sides, this is a growing problem. And we don't understand each other as well. And we're shocked by what people who think differently believe. Really shocked. This, to me, is disturbing. This was not the case in the 1960s or 1950s in the United States.
So how do we get back to that? And how do we do it without having the government issue it as an edict, which, you know, it likes to do or has liked to do up till now, and we'll see what happens under the Trump administration?
Well, keep in mind, my book is mostly a diagnostic, pointing out how bad the problem has become. I think we're so far down the path of our problems, you know, our debt, our complacency, our high level of regulation. I don't think there's any way to just undo those in a few years. And in the last chapter of the book, I predict, you know, the way we'll, quote unquote, get out of it is by having some kind of crack up. So I would love to, you know, be able to set things straight. But I think, frankly, our chance for that was maybe in the 1990s. And right now we're going to see a decline in the quality of our governance and a lot of problems just, you know, paying the bills of our government.
When you
I don't
say,
think we're going to get out of it.
Tyler, when you say a crack-up, how would you see something like that coming about? How would it exhibit itself?
Imagine some international crisis arising, and I don't have a particular prediction, but you could imagine which parts of the world, right, North Korea, the Middle East, and our government not having the resources, the flexibility, the credibility or support of the American public.
Are there other ways that private sector institutions, even companies that employ people, might help solve this problem? Because I know that there are tech companies that love to let their own employees become entrepreneurs. And then again, that requires that you work at a tech company. But I think it probably happens more out of public view, even in smaller companies where the boss says, yeah, I'd love to see you come up with an innovation and make $1 million. Go for it.
Sure. I think tech companies have been a big hero in this story. Not enough of our economy is like the tech companies. They also encourage mixing and different perspectives, and they tend to be quite tolerant places. So I'm all for that. You know, I see the level of trust in our private sector increasing and the level of trust in our government decreasing.
So in that way, the prescription that the Trump administration has embraced with the appointment of Betsy DeVos as education secretary does fit into a reform model for you, right? That she wants she wants school choice, and the president mentioned school choice last night.
I like the ideas of Betsy DeVos. As you know, in this country, schooling is mostly state and local, but I do think it's useful to have a spokeswoman for school choice at the federal level. But Betsy DeVos on her own, even with the help of Trump, cannot do it.
His book is called The Complacent Class, The Self-Defeating Quest of the American Dream. He is Dr. Tyler Cohen. Doctor, it's a pleasure to have you on the program, and congratulations on the book.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thank you very much. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'll be glad to get back to your phone calls later at 866-HEY-LARS. You can also email talk@LarsLarson.com. Follow us on Twitter @LarsLarsonShow. I always like to say if I have a dog in the fight, although... Oh, to call Johnny Cash a dog. I'm not calling Johnny Cash a dog. I love his music. I've loved it since I was a little kid. I especially liked the songs and the albums that he did later before he passed. But then I saw this book, a brand new book, The Man Who Carried Cash, by Julie Chadwick, who joins me now. She's an award-winning journalist and editor, an urban farmer. She's written for the National Post and the Vancouver Sun and the Victoria Times columnist and Vice. And she lives in Nanaimo, B.C. Ms. Chadwick, thank you so much for taking the time.
Thanks for having me here.
Now, this is all about the man who was, for about 13 years, Johnny Cash's manager. But it sounds like from the book that he went well beyond that in his relationship to Johnny Cash. And then, for some reason, he left. And we'll get to all of that. But I want you to describe, first of all, how you came to this project, if you don't mind.
Yeah, it's really kind of a weird backstory. So I was working at the local paper as a reporter and as an entertainment editor. And so I got this email from Saul Hulliff's son, Jonathan, basically saying, you know, my dad was Johnny Cash's manager, and he had done a documentary about it. And he wanted us to do a story about the Nanaimo launch because his dad lived in Nanaimo at the end of his life. So I guess initially... my thought was, like, how could there be a a Nanaimo connection to Johnny Cash. It just seemed kind of incredible. So it ended up that Saul lived in Nanaimo at the end of his life. He committed suicide in 2005. And so his son Jonathan was living in Hollywood at the time. He came back to Nanaimo to sort of deal with his father's death. It was really hard on him because him and his father had a pretty strained relationship at the end. So he's with his mom in their condo, and the phone starts ringing because this was just a few months before Walk the Line came out, the famous film about Johnny Cash. So all these reporters started calling, you know, that had heard his dad was Johnny Cash's manager, and they wanted to know, you know, what did they think, and was there any materials, and so it was hard for him because it just kind of kept bringing it up, and in a way he was sort of trying to deal with it and also trying to avoid it. And so his mom turned to him and said, hey, you know, I see you're struggling with this. Your dad kept like a whole bunch of stuff down in the storage locker. Here's the key to it. I think it might help you deal with Saul's death if you went and kind of went through his stuff and, you know, maybe faced this. So when he went into the storage locker, he found this huge archive of materials about his father's time with Johnny. So it included 60 hours of audio diaries, hundreds of photos, hundreds of letters between the two men. And his dad was really meticulous, super organized. And so he kept virtually everything. So in going through all of this material, that ended up becoming a documentary that he did called My Father and the Man in Black. And so when I wrote about the story of his documentary, I realized there was just so much material there that still hadn't been used. Just film being the nature that it is, it's kind of limited in some ways. So, like, you can't put a 10-page letter in a film, for example, or sometimes even explain the whole context behind that. So we got talking, and I said, you know, I think there's a book here. Like, there's just so much material. And so over time, we got to know each other, and I got to know him and his mother, and that's what ended up happening with the book.
You mentioned his suicide, and I want to tell you, Ms. Chadwick, I write for a living. I think the piece of writing you did at the very beginning of the book, the prologue, is such an amazing piece of writing, and in a lot of ways so disturbing about the last night of Saul Holliff's life.
Yeah.
I'd like to ask you to read it, and if you don't care to, I'd be happy to, because I think it's a beautiful piece of writing about something that's unbelievably horrific.
Okay, you wanted me to read it out?
Would you mind?
Yeah, I can just get it here. I have it.
So this is 12 years ago, as we're talking about this, in 2005, and it's the last night of Saul Holliff's life. And I thought Ms. Chadwick did an absolutely fantastic job, although it's horrifying to read. Would you mind doing that if you have it handy?
Sure, yeah. The sun was setting as Saul Holliff crossed the living room floor, his shadow falling on the neatly packed bookshelves as he rounded the corner and entered his study. He looked trim in his tailored black flax and cashmere sweater. His stride was smooth and purposeful. Despite his 79 years, he was in fairly good health, aside from a heart condition that was controlled with medication. Pulling a set of keys from his pocket, he unlocked the top drawer and pulled it open. He removed the kit from a small black leather bag and placed it on top of the desk. Methodically, he began to remove his jewelry and place it in the drawer. First, he slipped off the slim Piaget watch from his left wrist, then the thin gold wristband from his right. He struggled to loosen the wedding band that had been a fixture on his hand for 40 years. The wallet was last. He reached for the keys, just as he had done in every practice run. But something had changed. He studied the keys in the palm of his hand. Locking the drawer was pointless. He dropped them into the drawer and closed it. The curtain of dusk began to fall. As he returned to the living room, he flicked on a single lamp, which threw off just enough light to see. The leather sofa squeaked slightly as he sat. The kit he placed in the center of the glass coffee table in front of him. He went over his checklist. Sit in an upright position, check. Eat a little food to prevent vomiting, check. Drink a small amount of alcohol to augment the action of the drug, check. He unzipped the kit and parted it against the surface of the table. A television flickered in the corner but was silent. The bottle of pills clicked as he placed it on the table. He removed a black garbage bag and a large elastic band. He separated a number of gelatin capsules and lightly tapped their contents into a crystal glass, forming a mound of fine reddish powder. Using a long spoon, his actions measured, he mixed in the liberal amount of Stolichnaya, his favorite vodka, and topped it off with a splash of orange juice. Then he lifted the glass to his lips and drank its contents without stopping. The garbage bag lay beside him, edges rolled up carefully over the elastic band. This part he had practiced a number of times, unrolling and re-rolling the bag until it could be brought down over his face in one smooth action. His wife Barbara was on the couch next to him. He turned to meet her eyes and spoke his last words. "Remember what we agreed. You stay in the bedroom and don't come out, no matter what, until this thing's over." He pulled the bag over his head and filled it with air before quickly placing the large elastic band around his throat to create a seal. Barbara was in the bedroom when she heard the noise. Perched on the edge of her mattress, plucking at a stray thread on the bedspread, she raised her head at the sound, hoping she had just imagined it. Straining to listen over the pounding of her heart, it came again, a muffled shout. The third cry brought her to her feet, and instinct forced her out the door and into the living room towards the sofa. "Do not leave the bedroom, no matter what." His last words echoed in her mind. She froze. The Secanol, a fast-acting sedative used to calm patients before surgery, was beginning to hit his bloodstream in a vodka-enhanced flood. Barbara watched in horror as Saul's arms rose and lagged in the air. She wanted nothing more than to tear that wretched thing off his head, if only to stop the sound he was making, a sound that was now etched into her mind. She stood rooted to the carpet for a moment, her hands trembling, then turned mechanically and walked back into the bedroom. The lamp on her bedside table remained dark. She turned her wedding band around and around on her finger. "I promised I wouldn't interfere. If I revive him and he ends up a vegetable or maimed in some way, no, it's impossible, he'd never forgive me." As night fell, the patches of silence in the living room expanded until their edges bled together seamlessly. It was over. It was March 17, 2005. After what seemed like hours, Barbara emerged from the room. The slumped figure on the couch did not stir. She knew everything had to be left exactly as it was, so she touched nothing except to gently hold her husband's hand, already cooling to the touch. She remained there for a moment, feeling the tears on her cheeks. Then she slowly rose and called the police.
Ms. Chadwick, that is an amazing piece of writing, and I want to hear the rest of the story that leads to it. The book is called The Man Who Carried Cash, and its author is Julie Chadwick, an award-winning journalist and editor whose work has appeared in Canada in the National Post, the Vancouver Sun, the Victoria Times columnist, and Vice. She is my guest, and I'm pleased to have her on the program. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. We'll get back to your calls later at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. My guest, Julie Chadwick, an award-winning journalist from Nanaimo, BC, is with me, and she is the author, most recently, of The Man Who Carried Cash, about Saul Holoff, who was a Canadian businessman. And I would venture to say that while a lot of managers for famous musicians and bands are very well known, I didn't know his name, and I want you to tell me how he came to know Johnny Cash and how he came to be the man who would be right next to him through many of the most significant events in Cash's career.
Yeah, so he started off as a businessman. He ran a ladies' ready-to-wear shop in Ontario, and he ended up kind of starting lots of different businesses. And one of the ones that he started was a drive-through burger joint, which I believe was one of the first ones ever in Ontario. And it was called Saul's Square Boy, and everything in the restaurant was square, including the owner. He liked to joke, which means like square ice cream scoops and square burgers. And he marketed the burgers by saying 4 extra bites for your money. So he was quite clever with marketing and had a lot of really innovative ideas. So one of the ideas he came up with in the mid-50s, when there was a lot of rock and roll just starting to come into Canada, he had always been kind of interested in showbiz since he had gone to Hollywood when he was 20, and which is a whole other story. But so I think it was always in the back of his mind that he was kind of interested in showbiz, and so he decided to try his hand at promotion work. And one of the things that he thought of was, if he put into the clause or into the contract that the performers would come to Saul's Square Boy afterwards to sign autographs, that would have all the teenagers that had been at the show, they would all flock to his burger restaurant and spend their money. So that was initially his idea. And Johnny Cash just kind of came up as one of the musicians that were kind of coming into Canada. And so his name had kind of been on his radar. He had heard the song 5 Feet High and Rising on a jukebox and had thought he sounded kind of interesting. Country music wasn't really something he was super interested in personally. He was really into jazz and classical himself, but he kind of knew a trend when he saw it. There was also this teenage counter guy at the local record store who used to help him finding like what was kind of cool and new. He's 16 years old, and so he went and talked to him about what was up and coming, and he said, you know, there's this Cash guy, and people are starting to really get into his stuff. So that's kind of how he first got exposed to him. When they first met in 59, he brought him in for a show, and they didn't hit it off at all. They kind of had a conflict over a minor thing in the contract worth about $40. And so they kind of had a little bit of an argument.
What was the thing, Ms. Chadwick?
Do you remember? It was something like whether sales tax was taken off the top before the commission. And I think he ended up being right. Like from what I could see, it was something, because he was somebody who was just very meticulous. He knew the rules. And I think he had a lifelong, I don't know if the word's obsession, but he had a lifelong sort of thing with fairness. Like he really had a fear of being ripped off. And so with a lot of shows, he became super adept at being able to stand at the back of the room and scan the crowd and get an accurate count of how many people were there just from scanning the crowd. So just because a lot of promoters tended to rip off the managers or rip off the artists. And back then it was an all cash business, which is partly why the title was called The Man Who Carried Cash, because Saul literally walked around with a briefcase with a Canada flag on it with tens of thousands of dollars in it all the time. That's a story that just kept coming up over and over again, was just this kind of strange habit he had. I mean, partly because they dealt in cash, but also it used to kind of freak them out. Like Fluke Holland, Johnny's drummer, said it used to scare him because he would just open his briefcase like on the sidewalk or wherever and you start paying people out with these wads of cash. So that was part of it too. It's sort of like a double meaning. There was one incident too where he actually, there was a show in Toronto where he and the promoter, the band was on stage, they were playing and they couldn't find Johnny anywhere. And so they went to the tour bus and found him passed out inside. And so they both took an elbow and literally carried him to the stage. So,
and he was the man who was there during, I mean, setting up shows for Johnny Cash and then at the same time dealing with no shows when Johnny Cash couldn't make it to the stage?
Yeah, there was a lot of that. There was a few incidents where I was kind of shocked, like just in terms of what he had to deal with.
Is there a way of describing what their relationship was at this point between Cash and Saul Holliff?
It was really interesting. I think in some ways, like Saul was sort of as formidable a character as Johnny, which is sort of saying a lot because, you know, Johnny was described as the kind of person who could sort of suck out the air when he came in the room. In a lot of ways, Saul served as a bit of a counterweight. And I have audio taped phone calls between the two of them. And they're talking about the film A Gospel Road when Johnny wants to do this film, and it's a religious film, and Saul's kind of like, you know, I don't know if there's commercial prospects for this. Johnny's getting angry about it, saying, you know, like, if you don't want to help me with this, I can find someone who does. And Saul's like, well, you know, like, you don't want people to just tell you what you want to hear. Like, that doesn't help you, right? And he's like, yeah, you're right. So I think in that, it really encapsulates a lot of how he helped him in a lot of ways, just in terms of giving him this critical point of view, maybe partially because they were such different people. Johnny was very religious. He was from the South. Saul was an atheist. He was Jewish. In some ways, that worked really well, although it caused a lot of conflicts between them, too. There's another later letter where Johnny says to Saul, you know, you're responsible for a lot of the good reading habits that I have. So that indicates to me that Saul often recommended books to him and stuff, which I think is kind of interesting. Saul was an obsessive reader. He used to tear out articles all the time from newspapers and magazines and was constantly trying to improve himself. Like I'd hear in his diary where, you know, he's going to go to some country, so he'd get the encyclopedias from that country and read all about the history, and he just voraciously wanted to learn things. He'd go in the Reader's Digest and the 50 new words, and he'd incorporate all the words into his vocabulary.
I'm talking to
security, though.
I'm talking to Julie Chadwick. Sorry, Ms. Chadwick, but she's the award-winning journalist from Nanaimo, BC, who is the author most recently of The Man Who Carried Cash, about Saul Holof, who was for 13 years the manager for Johnny Cash through an awful lot. We'll be back in just a moment to continue this conversation. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and a real pleasure to have with me Julie Chadwick, who is an award-winning journalist and an editor whose work has appeared in British Columbia and the National Post and Vancouver Sun, the Victoria Times columnist, and Vice. She is also an urban farmer, and we may get to that later. But right now she's telling us this engaging tale about Saul Holof, who was for 13 years the manager for Johnny Cash. Her book is called The Man Who Carried Cash. So here we are in this 13-year stretch, and you mention a lot of the biggest events that happened during that: Carnegie Hall, Folsom Prison, A Boy Named Sue. I mean, you can mention A Boy Named Sue today, and it's one of the few songs where I think most Americans could almost immediately, maybe those above 30, but even those under 30 might immediately say, oh, Johnny Cash, and a hit television series. So what kept Saul Holof with him? I mean, other than the fact that it was probably a pretty good arrangement financially for Mr. Holof to be the manager for one of the biggest stars in America, but was there another more personal connection between the two?
It's hard to say, you know, like in terms of the super difficult times that they went through. I know they did technically kind of break up, or Saul sort of quit or left at least three different times during their time together, just out of frustration from various things. One of them was during a tour in England when they had their tour and it went fairly well. And then Saul had organized a show at the Olympia Theater in Paris, and it was a huge achievement for him. He was really proud of it. It was the first time a country western singer had ever played there. It was a very prestigious venue, which he loved. He loved getting him into really classy, high-profile places, partially because he really wanted to cross him over from being a niche country star into a mainstream, more pop star, and worked super hard to make that happen. So then they're all at the airport to flying out to France, and they're waiting, and Johnny just doesn't show up. And so the whole show gets canceled, and it's like months of work and arrangements and phone calls and letters, and he had run off with Bob Dylan, gone partying. So there's a lot of incidents like that where you think, and he did end up actually quitting after that. And then there's always this weird thing where they would just kind of quietly reconcile. And I guess for me, it was really interesting looking at two men's relationship and how that worked, especially two men in the 60s where, and you know, it happens now too, but where they just didn't talk about their feelings. They didn't talk about what was going wrong or what they were frustrated with. And at the same time, you know, he's dealing with somebody who is in the midst of a really intense drug problem. So that also, you know, affects communication. I feel like that might have been why he made a lot of the recordings, partially therapeutic, like kind of confessing things into his audio recorder, but also to keep a record of things, to keep things straight. Like, I think the phone calls might have been him trying to keep a record so that if he arranged something and Johnny later said, I didn't agree to that, he could, you know, play it back or whatever. Initially, June Carter kind of played that role where he'd get June to come into the room and listen to their negotiations about things. One little story I wanted to tell you, that you mentioned A Boy Named Sue.
Yeah.
And this is kind of an interesting, there's a lot of different accounts of how that song came to be. Some of them say that, you know, it was passed through Columbia Records to Johnny, and other books say that there was this concert at his house before,
jam session or...
Yeah, where they all, you know, and Shel Silverstein brought it there. But Saul told a story four different times in different accounts, and he always stuck to the same story, that they were walking together, him and Johnny, through O'Hare Airport in Chicago, and Shel Silverstein just walked up to them out of nowhere, and they kind of bumped into him, and he said, hey, Johnny, I got a song for you, and pulled out this crumpled piece of paper that he'd written it on and handed it to him. And he said, you know, Johnny kind of stuffed it down in his luggage and you know, got coffee all over it and whatever else. And, you know, probably the rest of the famous story that they were at San Quentin and nobody knew, none of his bandmates knew that he was going to play this song. He just kind of pulled it out and decided to do it on the spot. And I think when I hear Saul tell the story later, he was always amazed at how he just did it. He just played it out of nowhere, and he'd always say, you know, that song went on to sell millions of records, and and like, it was one of his most famous songs that launched him into being an international superstar, and he just did it out of nowhere. So coming back to your question, I think that was partly maybe what kept Saul going, is he just saw this amazing thing in Johnny Cash. And again, even though he didn't really love country music, he just saw this charisma and this certain something, especially when he was live. He said there was just this electricity to him. He just knew that there was something there that could be really big, you know?
Julie Chadwick is the author of The Man Who Carried Cash. And then in 1973, right at the peak, peak for Johnny Cash, Saul Hallof quits. Why?
Yeah, so I won't give you every detail about that because you won't be able to read the book, but it has, strangely, I mean, you would think, considering he went through such rough times with him and stuck it out, here he is, Johnny's at the height of his career, he's finally got through, he's mostly off the drugs, he's pretty stable, you know, he's making all of his shows, he's doing really well, he's happy in his life, he's got a new baby and stuff. And Saul quits, and you would think that perhaps it was just the built-up frustration, and maybe it was a little bit that, but it mainly came down to religious conflicts. So Johnny, once he got famous, I'm guessing maybe he got into this headspace of, you know, I've got this TV show, I've got this huge audience, I've got all these people listening to me. And he was getting a lot of letters from fans kind of saying, you know, like, you've sort of talked about religion and you talk about God and you sing these gospel songs, but is this like something you just say, or is this something you really believe? And I think he felt an obligation to his fans and to himself to start really living his life as a religious person. Mm-hmm. And I think I can walk the line in different accounts and stuff. There's not that much focus on how religious he was. And so he was getting more and more involved with Billy Graham. And so that started to create some tension because he started talking to Saul about it and was like, you know, you're not coming to these Billy Graham crusades that I'm doing, and this is really important to me in June. And Saul was like, well, I haven't arranged these shows, and there's nothing to do with me. You don't need me there. You know, and he just wasn't a religious person. It wasn't something he was interested in at all. So that started to create some tension, and it ended up in kind of a final blowout. But
well, let's
it's kind of funny, like, who would think?
Yeah, who would think that would be it? Well, let's leave that for people to read in the book. But Ms. Chadwick, let's fast forward 30 years, and Hallof decides to take his life. Again, not to ruin the book for people, but what brought the man with all this success behind him, apparently still prosperous, he's wearing a Piaget watch, why did he decide to take his own life?
I think that's something that was really prominent, a prominent theme in the book for me too, was this idea that you have these two men who essentially reached the pinnacle of success that you can reach in this world. They achieved everything that they set out to achieve. You know, they're good-looking men, well-dressed, had everything they wanted. And both of them were very tortured in a lot of ways. And I think, you know, in different ways, like for different things. But I think for Saul, he had a really, like, a lifelong insecurity, which is strange to think. And I found it interesting to sort of talk about that in the book, just in terms of a mental health sort of thing, is that even if somebody's super successful on the outside, they still have these issues that they struggle with. Sometimes they're issues that come from childhood, you know, like being told by a father that you're never going to amount to anything, you're never going to be good enough. And so he carried that around with him. After he quit Johnny, he went back to school and got his degree and finished his schooling in Victoria. And it was, it was something that he always wanted to do because he felt insecure about being uneducated, even though he was really intelligent and really worked on his mind a lot. He always felt that, you know, like I talk about a bunch of stuff, but I don't really know what I'm talking about. And so I think a lot of that factored into it. And it's just kind of interesting that no amount of outside success can often change that's inside of you. You have to deal with that in a different way.
And his wife was willing to accept his decision.
He was a very, very forceful person. So she said in interviews, you know, nobody ever said no to Saul. It was just, so I don't know if she was comfortable with it, but it was the kind of thing where you couldn't really disagree with him. It was, if he got his mind set on something, that was just what he was going to do.
It's just terribly sad, and I thought, you know, as a tribute to the man, the prologue that you wrote was, I mean, for such a horrific act, was a really beautifully told story of how it came about, and it carries his purposeful nature, as he just sets about to do it, practices it, and then finally carries out the act. Her book is called The Man Who Carried Cash. It is about Saul Holliff, who was a Canadian businessman who was Johnny Cash's manager for 13 long years before he finally left right at the peak of Cash's career. Its author is Julie Chadwick. She's an award-winning journalist and editor, and I look forward to talking to you again. Julie, thank you so much for the time.
Thank you so much. This was very enjoyable.
I really appreciate your time. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Ms. Chadwick, this will run a few times, I can tell you.
Oh, wow.
And I'll tell you why, because you know, just inside baseball, I do. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'll get back to your phone call shortly at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. I don't think it's going to surprise Michael Saltzman, the managing director of the Employment Policies Institute, that I spent a good part of today talking to people, Michael, about the impact of the minimum wage as it goes up around America and what's going to happen to the businesses and the employees who work under the minimum wage that's mandated by state governments. But you've got a real-life example in St. Louis of the bad things that can happen, right?
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, we actually, St. Louis is in an interesting situation right now because the city had raised its minimum wage, and then the state basically said, no, we'd prefer to have one unified minimum wage at the state level, and there's been some legal back and forth. But right now, it's possible that the city's minimum wage, starting in early 2018, will jump from $7.70 an hour up to $11 an hour.
Wow.
So we asked two economists to basically use the same methodology that the Congressional Budget Office developed when it was kind of estimating minimum wage impacts. And they found that the city would lose just over 1,000 jobs if this happened, and that the job loss would be concentrated among youth who are facing a 30%+ unemployment rate in St. Louis City.
How did they think they could jump the minimum wage from just over $7 an hour to $11 an hour? That's a gigantic increase without having some consequence for job holders.
Well, you know, they probably should have been paying attention to what happened in Flagstaff, Arizona. So this is pretty enlightening. You know, Flagstaff, Arizona, just their city council just voted last week to roll back an increase to $12 that was happening this summer. They've lowered that amount. And the reason was is that Flagstaff's wage was going to jump from $8 to $12 an hour in the space of about 6 months. And you had businesses closing in the city, businesses laying off staff. And probably the biggest crisis was among nonprofit service providers for the disabled, who basically told the city council, we will have to leave the city and these folks will be without any help at all if this goes through. And so I think this was what we're seeing now is, I think, the rubber meet the road, as it were, with these extreme minimum wage demands. And that, you know, when people warned about consequences, that it wasn't just businesses crying wolf.
What do you think is going to happen both short term and long term as these wage increases roll in?
Well, I think that's right. And I think we have seen unions use the minimum wage like that in the past. And to your question about short and long term, I mean, if people are looking for a glimmer of hope in this debate, I think it's that the consequences have been so tragic and so severe that it's, I think, concentrated and focused the attention. just a couple of days ago, Baltimore's mayor, Catherine Pugh, vetoed a proposed $15 minimum wage that would have taken effect in the city of Baltimore. Similar thing happened last year in the city of Cleveland. You had an overwhelmingly Democratic city council vote against a $15 minimum wage for Cleveland because they realized it would have made them an economic island.
Well, in fact, I wonder, I know that in some states they're allowed to pay a sub-minimum wage to disabled people, but of course you also have to have other workers who are abled, mainstream workers who are paid the full minimum wage. Does this increase, dramatic increase in the minimum wage, do you know whether it has an impact on those sub-minimum wages as well?
You know, it's an issue that's been kind of, debated separately. There are some advocates out there who would like to see that done away with. In this case, this was an employment training center where people were kind of having jobs that were trying to get them back into the workforce full time.
Right.
And so these were jobs that were affected by the state's minimum wage law. But it I think, kind of speaks to a broader dynamic, which is that if you are a restaurant or a retailer or, an apparel manufacturer, ultimately, you have to find someone to pay the cost of 15 for you. And if customers won't do it, then you got to leave the state, you got to close down, you got to use less labor. If you're a nonprofit, you're in a very different situation because you've got this sort of fixed pot of funding. And if that's not going to change, then a $15 minimum wage may be the difference between staying open and closing down.
Very good. Michael, thanks very much. I appreciate the time.
Hey, thanks, Lars. Appreciate it.
Michael Saltzman is the managing director of the Employment Policies Institute.